Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
All right, we are live inside the Hive of Vanity Fair, and we're going to actually talk to one of my favorite reporters today, Maya Kosoff, who has lots of claims to fame, one of which was being hate-tweeted by Donald Trump last week. We'll get to that later in the show. Maya, can you just give our listeners a little kind of overview of who you are and how you ended up here?
Yeah, so I am a tech reporter for Vanity Fair. I work for The Hive. I've been here for about 2 years now, and I kind of write on all things tech and some politics and some media stuff too. Before that, I was at Business Insider for about a year and a half. Before that, I was in school. So
that means that you are an official millennial, is that right?
I'm very like middle of the road millennial. I'm 25, yes.
Wow, this is going to be a fascinating conversation. I feel like I'm like Steve Irwin. I just climbed into the jungle and I'm about to like show people how alligators feed in the wild. All right, well, since you're a millennial, let's get straight to it. It's been kind of, you know, beginning of the year already, Facebook, God knows what is going on with them. Zuckerberg said that his challenge this year, he has that yearly challenge where he, you know, learns Mandarin or, you know, travels the country trying to decide if he wants to become president or drinks his own urine for a year, whatever it is that he does. This year, it's he's going to what exactly is he going to do? I can't really understand. It seems like he's just going to be CEO of Facebook for the year.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought when I saw his personal challenge come out on Facebook a couple weeks ago. He basically says that he wants to foster more connections on Facebook and make it a better place for his users, which, as far as I'm concerned, is already part of the job of being CEO of Facebook, right?
Yeah.
But more specifically this week, Facebook rolled out a new initiative. I guess it was at the end of last week, actually. But what Facebook wants to do now is to Zuckerberg's point, is foster more connections between their users by promoting posts in your newsfeed from your friends and from your family. And kind of the flip side of that is Facebook is going to be de-emphasizing posts from media companies or from pages. And so you're going to see probably more posts from your crazy aunt or whoever and fewer posts from publishers moving forward.
So what does this mean for... Okay, let's just, before we get to our crazy aunt and all the crazy things that, which, you know, is a whole separate, it could be its own podcast, but isn't this a kind of like a slap in the face for publishers who, you know, last year Facebook said, hey, we're going to start hosting all your content and we'll give you some, you know, some love as a result of that because you'll get more page views. And just trust us, more and more people are reading news on Facebook and we're going to kind of help foster that. And all the publishers were like, oh yes, of course, mm-hmm. Hold me, Mark. And now it's like, it's almost like, you know, they woke up in the morning and realized it was kind of like someone they met at a bar. Is this, for publishers, is this a complete and utter, oh shit, we shouldn't have done that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the writing's been on the wall for a long time. You saw Facebook have to apologize in 2016 and 2017 for messing up some of the metrics associated with publishers on their platform. And so I think publishers have kind of seen the writing on the wall for a while. Facebook has kind of charmed them with giving them money to do original video programming on Facebook. You kind of see this dance happening through the years, and it all led to this moment. And publishers now, especially the ones who kind of built their backbone of their businesses on Facebook's platform, are really having like an oh shit moment.
So here's the question. What is Facebook going to be like in this situation? Is it going to be like, it used to be? Is it going to be better? Is it going to be worse? And the other question is, one of the things that I have been asked, and I don't actually know the answer to this, and maybe you as a millennial can tell me, is Zuck, is his whole goal with this, it doesn't seem like Zuck does things to be altruistic to try to make the world a better place. It seems like, and I say that because of some of the privacy things they do, and we'll get to some of that in a little bit, but it seems like some people are questioning, well, is this really about the news and the experience on Facebook and fostering social connection, or is this about Zuck and Facebook trying to get into China? And, you know, one of the problems they've had trying to get into China is the news problem, where China, of course, controls a lot of the news. And if they limit the kinds of things that are on the site and make it more social, that there is a bigger chance that they can get in there and get access to the next billion users.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point about China, and one that wasn't immediately like considered by many people. And I also think that part of this is that Facebook doesn't want any of the liability that comes with being a media platform. So kind of demonetizing a lot of these media properties that have really grown on Facebook in recent years is a way for Facebook to not be so Netflix-like moving forward. They don't want to be like Netflix. They don't want to be a content provider, because that comes with all kinds of regulation that Facebook isn't currently subject to. And so
is it like, okay, we can't solve the fake news thing, so we're just going to kind of step away from it?
Yeah, I think this is like an admission that Facebook realizes that fake news is way too big and way outside of their parameters to control. Like, they made this monster, and now they don't know what to do with it. And so all they can do is kind of turn the gas off and let the publishers kind of wither on Facebook.
So what this monster that they made is now going to, it's still alive and growing bigger and stronger by the tweet. Is it now going to go over to Twitter and other social networks, or is it still going to kind of linger on Facebook, the whole fake news thing? Or yeah. Like, what do you think will happen?
I think misinformation isn't going anywhere on Facebook, right? Like, if the people that you interact with on Facebook are posting stories from Breitbart and Gateway Pundit and, you know, like, I love Democrats or whatever, like these kind of like fake Facebook news pages, you're still going to see that in your feed. Like, the news isn't going anywhere as long as it's being shared organically by your friends and family. Like, that is still going to pop up in your feed. So fake news is still going to be there. As for whether it kind of spreads to other social networks, I think other platforms have kind of insulated themselves from this. Twitter, I mean, you definitely get fake news spreading virally on Twitter. You see that in the aftermath of terror attacks or shootings or what have you. But it doesn't really spread quite as perniciously on Twitter as it does on Facebook. And Snapchat, too, has totally walled itself off from this by only working with a list of curated media partners. So they essentially had to have approved the kinds of news that appear in Discover. So Facebook is kind of alone in its treatment of fake news.
So let me ask you a question. As a millennial, do you use Facebook? Do your friends use Facebook?
I go on Facebook about once a day, and I do it to kind of see if, you know, if anybody's messaged me. I don't have the app on my phone anymore. I deleted it a few months ago. So I just kind of thought, I don't know, I thought I was maybe spending too much time on social networks, and I kind of wanted to get away from Facebook. But I go on, and I use it for events, and I use this kind of like a Rolodex of people who I've known over the past 10 years or so since I've been on Facebook. But I don't like write posts on people's walls. I don't update my status unless I'm sharing a story I've written or a story I really like that somebody else wrote. I'm not really like a prime Facebook user.
So it seems from what I've read and people I've spoken to and things I've heard that there are a lot of people who only use Facebook as kind of like a Rolodex these days, and that, you know, and that the company is kind of in a, you know, they still have 2.25-2.35 billion people on the platform, a quarter of the planet, and you know, while we all know people that leave the platform, what seems to be happening more, that seems to be kind of like an edge case, what seems to be happening more is I'm not just saying this, like, I must know three dozen people who have deleted Facebook from their phone. They've deleted the Messenger app from their phone, and they check it once in a while to see if someone's messaged them or, you know, for events. It's exactly what you said. Is this platform, like, can it save itself? Or, you know, is this just kind of what the next iteration of Facebook is going to be? And there's nothing that Zuck or his team can do to kind of fix that.
It's interesting because Facebook seems to be ignoring the fact that people are engaging less than they maybe used to do on Facebook. And they're doing things like Watch, which is like Facebook's new video initiative, right? And so I think that they've kind of, maybe this is like a tacit acknowledgement that people aren't using Facebook the way they used to, but they're trying to find new use cases for it. So you see that with Watch, you see it with Marketplace, which is like a localized like Craigslist sort of thing that Facebook has. That I actually know people who have sold and also bought like desks or furniture or even clothing on Facebook in the Marketplace tab. Yeah, I think probably when Facebook emphasized the placement of the Marketplace icon in its mobile app, people started clicking on it more by accident and then kept returning to it.
I didn't know people were actually using it. I see it all the time, but it's also I don't have any millennial friends, so here you go. That's the benefit. So one of the things that is happening is that we are seeing this kind of massive shift with social and how people feel about social. And, you know, anyone who's listened to the show before knows that I've kind of really turned off from Twitter and other social apps. I don't have any of them on my phone anymore. I download Twitter for, like, news events and then delete it over the weekend. Mm-hmm. And I think I went from tweeting, you know, maybe 5-6 times a day to maybe once every week or two at this point. Like I just feel icky every time I look at it. You recently went through an experience on Twitter that was not very fun. Tell us about that first and what happened, and then I want to get your take on what you think is going to happen with Twitter.
Yeah, so a few weeks ago, so before Christmas, we made a series of videos for The Hive that were New Year's resolutions for politicians and kind of public figures. We made one for Trump, we made one for Gary Cohn, we did one for Steve Bannon, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and Hillary Clinton. And we tweeted, I mean, they were just, you know, like holiday videos. Every you know, media company has them. It was no different from anything that like BuzzFeed or Vox has ever done. We did the video for Hillary Clinton, I think, got tweeted out sometime around Christmas, and I think people saw the video, and I don't think that they really understood that it was part of like a series, and they misinterpreted it as sort of like an attack that we did on Hillary. And it, part of the video was making resolutions for these people. So mine for Hillary was, you know, do something besides politics, like try improv comedy, try volunteering, try knitting. It was obviously a joke, and it got misinterpreted and picked up. And what happened, I think, I don't really know how to trace how this happened, but the first person I saw on Twitter who was really mad about it was Patricia Arquette tweeted about it and started this sort of like cancel VF movement, which I think you've kind of, it's very Trumpy. You've seen an uptick in these kind of boycotts of publications happening over the past year whenever a publication falls out of favor for, you know, saying something that people disagree with. But this sentiment got picked up, and by the next day, a bunch of former Hillary staffers and campaign people, people like Peter Dow, Adam Parkamenko, Tom Watson, were tweeting about it and about me specifically. I guess it was the fact that I said the word knitting, but they had kind of latched onto this video and they were all very angry about it.
And so they, so there was a tweet storm at you. It was like a total, you were like a, you know, Vanity Fair was like a trending topic. And so what was it like? So I have been on the receiving end of some of these before when I used to work at the Times, and it's the fucking worst, because you want to defend yourself and you want to say, hey guys, this was a, you know, it's a simple mistake. It's not a big deal. I didn't, you know, no animals were harmed in the making of this video. Mm-hmm. And yet you can't, because everyone's like, oh, this is the thing we're mad at today. It's a journalist. And it seems that, you know, having been on the receiving end of it, it's made me really see the really bad side of social media. What was it like for you? Because I know you took notes on your phone for things you wanted to tweet when it was over. I mean, like, what was it like for you?
It was really scary. I think part of the reason why this happened was it was like the perfect storm of of timing. It was like the day after Christmas and everybody was home with their family and people were probably, you know, getting cabin fever and they wanted something to be mad about. And there was nothing happening in the news cycle for like 2 days. So I woke up the next morning and I immediately locked my Twitter account and I, you know, turned off all the notifications that I would normally get from people tweeting at me. And then ultimately I deleted the app from my phone for like 2 or 3 days, which was hard for me because I have a big following on Twitter and I, you know, communicate with sources and other reporters there a lot, and friends. And so it was really hard and it was really frustrating because, you know, there's nothing you can say in that moment that's going to, you know, make anything better. In fact, it's probably only going to make it worse if you keep tweeting about it and lending credence to it. But it was really, you know, it was really frustrating and really, really upsetting. It was like a really hard 3 days. And then when I locked my Twitter account, the people who were really mad at me also found me on Facebook. They found me on Instagram. They found my email address. They found my personal email address. They found my LinkedIn. And I got a barrage of just like harassment and abuse it was like a multi-platform thing for like 3 days. It was really wild.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
So my sponsor today is Goop, and I have a very, very, very special guest here to talk about it.
Hi, Nick.
Hi, Krista. That's my wife. Yep, she is going to talk to you about some of the things that Goop has sent us lately and things that she's tried out. Goop is a lifestyle brand rooted in content that spans travel, food, beauty, style, work.
I have to say, I love reading their wellness coverage. It's all rooted in organic and natural ingredients, which, as you know, I love.
You are very obsessed with that stuff. I have to agree. So, okay, so you tested out some products that Goop sent us recently. Can you tell us a little bit about what you tried?
Sure. I tried Goop Glow Morning Skin Super Powder, which is a drinkable skin supporter that has lots of natural stuff for your complexion, like powerful antioxidants, vitamin C, and E, which was incredible. But I really loved their Juice Beauty Exfoliating Instant Facial, which does exactly what it sounds like it should. It instantly brightens and softens the skin to reveal a glowing, smoother looking complexion.
You have been looking extra glowing lately. I've been noticing that.
Thanks, honey.
Should I try this extra glowing stuff?
In fact, I think that you should start using it because your skin is always very dry.
It is always very dry, and you are always letting me know that. So if people want to give it a shot or check out more about any of the Goop products, they have lots of different things on their site. You know, all these different products that they sell. There's these solutions for antioxidants to help with sun and pollution and stress and so on and so forth. You can look at all this stuff at goop.com/hive. Krista, what is that website again?
It's goop.com/hive.
goop.com/hive. Once again, goop.com/hive. Krista, thank you so much.
Thanks, honey.
So, don't you see the downside of all of this after this? Or are you still like, oh, social media is great. I love it. Yay.
I mean, I definitely don't think social media is great. And I think I've done things in the past. Like, I don't have the Facebook app on my phone. I don't use Snapchat anymore. The only social media apps I have on my phone are Twitter and Instagram. And I still have my settings for notifications on Twitter so that I only see them from people who I follow. Like, I guess I've created my own filter bubble. And I can't like get DMs from strangers or anything like that. But it has made me more mindful and more empathetic of people who are at the center of kind of like outrage cycles like this. And it's definitely caused me to think twice before I kind of like breathe new, like fresh air into some sort of like ongoing outrage thing by like lending credence to it by tweeting about it. So it's made me a more mindful social media user, I think.
So do you think that that when you kind of look at this, do you think that people literally wake up every morning and they're just kind of pissed off about the fact that they're like, the cable company didn't show up, or like their phone bill is so expensive, or Donald Trump is president, or Donald Trump is, you know, not getting the credit he deserves, or whatever it is, or Hillary Clinton's still alive, and they they literally just go on Twitter and they're like, what am I going to be mad at today? I guess the question is for me that I still cannot understand, and I've written about this company, and it's not just Twitter, but social media in general, because there's a lot of anger and hatred on there. Predominantly Twitter, of course. But the thing I can't understand is, are people jerks or in the real world with empathy, where you see how you what you say to people and how that is interpreted, that they act nice. Or is it that people are nice and that using social media and a screen where you don't see how it affects someone makes them into jerks?
I think it's the latter. I think that social media can bring out the worst in people, and it definitely brings out a lot of groupthink and kind of mob mentality behavior, as you've definitely talked about and written about before. But I do think that it just kind of exacerbates people's worst qualities because it makes it easy to dehumanize someone and not think of them as a person but more of like an avatar for the thing that you're like your latent anger, basically. And I think that that was what the case was with the whole Knitting Gate video fiasco, was there's still obviously a lot of latent anger among people who supported Hillary Clinton, even, you know, anybody who's kind of upset about how things are going politically right now in the United States. And I think that that manifests itself by, you know, having a convenient scapegoat. And I happened to be that person for 2 or 3 days. And then it was immediately afterwards, there was a Times reporter who everybody was mad at instead. And the cycle goes on and on. And it's not fair. And it shouldn't be this way. But I do think that there is there's some degree of truth to the fact that, you know, people wake up in the morning and they're mad about the way things are going, and they feel like they can't effectively do anything to help. So their anger kind of manifests itself on social media, but particularly, I would say, on Twitter.
So what do you think how do you think this plays out? Because and I don't know the answer to this myself. But more and more, as we see with people deleting Facebook from their phone or Snapchat or whatever it is, it's almost like there's this war with the algorithm, and the algorithm is trying to get you to use this product more because then they get to show, you know, more engagement. And in the war for the algorithm, the only way that humans can win is to step out of the ring, right? Mm-hmm. And so more and more I see people and hear people talking about, or even see them on social media saying, hey, I'm taking a break, I'm deleting this from my phone, and so on and so forth. But with Twitter, what I see happen is that people do that, and predominantly they end up coming back reluctantly because of some sort of news event or because of some interest in learning more about a topic or something like that. But it seems like it's literally like being in a relationship with like someone who verbally abuses you. It's like you still love them because of whatever you get out of it, but you hate the relationship. Do you, like, this to me, it doesn't seem like it is sustainable as a business to have people who hate your platform but hate use it. Mm-hmm. What do you think happens to Twitter in the next few years to the next 10 years?
That's a great question. And I also think this is something that Twitter it's been reluctant to address, is this kind of hate usage of the platform. I think there's probably more users on Twitter now than there have been in a while because politics happens in real time whenever Donald Trump picks up his phone and, you know, angrily tweets something after a Fox and Friends segment or something like that. But it's not good. It's not healthy. And it does make you feel bad. So I don't know. I think Twitter has to address that in some capacity. And if it doesn't, then I wonder if at some point there's a new platform we all move on to that is just Twitter, but maybe better regulated and better moderated. So there's better protections against abuse. I don't know if human behavior is really going to change, though, from platform to platform. So I don't really know what Twitter's solution is to all of this or what ends up happening to Twitter. I guess 5 years is a long time, though. So, you know, you look at Twitter 5 years ago and it was a totally different company. And it certainly wasn't, you know, the mouthpiece for a United States president. So I don't know. I guess I'm not really sure what's going to happen to it in 5 years. I hope I'm not still on it in 5 years. I hope I've moved on to greener pastures, but I don't know.
To greener pastures, like talking to people in person, exactly. And yelling at them.
This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
We all live busy lives, and unfortunately, there's not enough hours in the day to get everything done. My sponsor this week, Freshly, has a solution to help that is convenient, healthy, and delicious no matter what life throws at you. Freshly has a team of chefs that create all-natural, gluten-free dinners and deliver them fresh to your door. There's no cooking, no chopping, no messy cleanup, and best of all, it is delicious. So even if you get stuck at work late, you can still come home and have a delicious dinner that's cooked for you by a chef. I've been using Freshly now for a few weeks, and the penne bolognese tastes incredible. The turkey shepherd's pie is better than any recipe I've ever tested out, and believe me, I've tried to make excellent turkey shepherd's pie before. The best part about Freshly is the number of comfort meals they currently have that are all super healthy, like the buffalo chicken and the chicken parm, and they have a constantly changing, rotating menu of more than 30 new chef-crafted options. There's no weekly commitment, so you just get deliveries when you want them. You can check out this week's menu crafted by Freshly Chefs and get $25 off your first order of 6 chef-cooked dinners, plus free shipping by going to freshly.com/hive. That's Freshly, FreshLy.com/hive. You'll feel so relieved to come home to a chef-cooked meal every night with Freshly. Once again, go to freshly.com/hive for $25 off your first order. I promise you, you will not regret it. So last Twitter question. One of the things that that has been really interesting is to see the response by people to the way Trump uses it and to the way Jack Dorsey decides to allow people to use the platform, like Nazis and things like that. And I, you know, over the weekend, speaking of tweets, it was right after the Hawaii fake missile crisis of 2018, and Stephen Levy, a journalist who I respect a lot, had tweeted that, you know, everyone gives Twitter so much shit, but if it wasn't for Twitter, that was the first place people found out that the Hawaii missile crisis was actually, that was an accident, and it wasn't what actually happened. And I responded and said to him, well, if it were a real missile, people would have been pointing directly at Twitter and saying that as a result, it was as a result partially of Trump's Twitter usage. To which Stephen said, well, okay, are you really going to try to blame Twitter for the way Trump uses it? And my feeling and my response was that I feel like society has a responsibility to look out for one another. And I'm not of the mindset that we should just kind of pull a shruggy about the president's tweets and just be like, whatever, not a big deal. Because if that's the case, then we should be doing that with anyone who uses the platform. And recently, Twitter came out, and you and I have both written about this, and said that it was not going to police world leaders the same way it would police standard users. So if Trump tweets something that is a newsworthy thing, then they keep it. And my feeling on this is like, okay, well, that's bullshit. How do you get to pick which rules apply and which rules don't? If the rules don't apply to Trump, then all the rules shouldn't apply to Trump. He shouldn't be able to block people. He shouldn't be able to tweet people by name and set his mongrels after them. He shouldn't be able to retweet fake bots, which he's done, and things like that. Mm-hmm. What is your feeling on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think part of the frustration I have is that Twitter has been so slow and so kind of reluctant to come out with an explicit policy about Trump. It took them until basically now, until like a week or two ago, to even say what it said, which is explicitly that Trump, there's a built-in Trump exception to the rules. And I think that if they had been clearer about that and just straight up, you know, about it from the beginning, people at least couldn't be mad at them for that. But the fact that Trump is basically, yeah, he's held to a different standard on the account. He can do whatever he wants. He can retweet anti-Muslim videos without consequence, and they won't do anything about it. I don't know. I think that there's something to be said for kind of, you know, I do understand that. I don't know. I understand the point that he's causing problems on the platform at like a diplomatic level that could result in, you know, fatalities that we can't even fathom right now. And I think that that's a valid point. And I don't know if it's something that Twitter has really grappled with yet. Like, I think that they're finally starting to get it. But it still seems like maybe they don't really understand the magnitude of damage that he can cause by being on the platform. At the same time, I do think that there is a case to be made that, you know, that like, he can cause damage for himself by being on the platform. Like, he very likely could tweet himself into impeachment if left unattended for long enough with his iPhone. So
we should put him in solitary confinement with his iPhone and just wait it out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good idea. I also think maybe a good idea would be coming up with like a dummy Twitter account for his iPhone that John Kelly makes up for him, and he can just tweet whatever he wants.
Idea.
And it doesn't go anywhere, but he doesn't know it. So that's my personal solution, and something I feel like Twitter should maybe be working on.
That's a great idea. So it's almost like he sees a different Twitter and he thinks, and it has all these fake retweets and likes and people saying, yay, MAGA. And
it'll even send him push notifications. So it feels like you still get that like an endorphin boost, but yeah.
All right. So moving on, sticking with the social theme, Snapchat, what the hell is going on there?
Great question. I mean, their user numbers are declining. There was a Daily Beast report last week. It seemed like maybe, I don't know how, it was like a treasure trove of data, right? It was like a disgruntled employee on their way out the door just handed it to a reporter and was like, here. And it basically showed declining user numbers and declining engagement numbers over the past few months. And you can kind of understand then from looking at those numbers why Evan Spiegel suddenly announced this redesign to Snapchat's app a couple months ago. There's not a lot of people aren't using Discover. People are using the Snap Map a lot the way that we thought that they would, which is on the weekends to see what their friends are doing, which is exactly the point of the Snap Map, which locates your avatar on a map relative to where your friends are, so you can see where people are hanging out and stuff like that. Which,
thank you for explaining that to me, because I actually have never seen the Snap Map because I deleted all social media from my phone. Mm-hmm. But keep going.
Yeah, and so I don't know. You understand then why they needed to redesign, and you understand why declining user numbers and people who are older not using the platform are a big deal for Snapchat, which billed itself as this, you know, millennial haven, basically. And for a few years, it was really successful in being exactly that. And now that it's a public company, it has way more expectations it has to meet. And it hasn't really been doing that. You've seen its stock price fall since it went public last year. We're nearing, I believe, the one-year anniversary. That's in a month or two of its IPO. And I don't really know. They seem like they're stuck at an impasse. They like doing creative, wacky things. They made Spectacles in 2016, and for a moment, people really liked them. But there was no like selfie drone. There was no Snapchat branded selfie stick. You know, like all these things that I feel like there was no follow up on Snapchat. You know, rebranding itself as a camera company that delights its users.
Yeah, completely. So okay, so now, but here's the question, right? Zuckerberg, for all his genius, is not a product person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there is a single thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, on Facebook that he came up with before someone else had come up with it. Even the news feed was somebody else, it was someone else's idea at the company. Zuck understands, you know, essentially copied Facebook from the twins. They copied all of the Twitter stuff with the news. They copied, you know, social engagement, likes, all these things that they have copied. And one of the things that we see happen with Zuck is there's this kind of this line which I wrote in the Twitter book about how, you know, either it's like either he's trying to hook up with you, and if you won't hook up with him and like join him, he wants to destroy you. And that was something we saw happen with Instagram. He ended up convincing Kevin Systrom to go over to Facebook for $1 billion and has helped flourish the company. If Kevin would have said no, Zuckerberg would have literally spent every waking moment and sleeping moment of his day trying to destroy Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened with Snapchat. And when Spiegel said no, Evan Spiegel said no, Zuckerberg said, okay, well, we're going to destroy them and copy them until they are done, and which is what has been happening. Is it possible to have a business that is a competitor to Facebook, with the exception of Twitter, which was around over a decade ago, that's able to stand up to Facebook, that's able to kind of build something that is different to the platform that can't be copied, or is that just impossible?
I think the answer to that question should be yes, but the fact that I feel like it's no probably means that Facebook is too big and too powerful. You see this with happening with Snapchat. Now, literally every single one of the features that Snapchat pioneered first has been turned into an Instagram feature now and has already been rolled out on WhatsApp and in Messenger and on the Facebook platform. And I don't know. I feel like we're nearing this point where Facebook is getting too big, and maybe it needs to be broken up. And I know you've talked about this a lot, but maybe Facebook is too powerful if it can successfully kind of take apart companies like this that any ostensible competitor, really.
No, I do think that Facebook is too big. I think that I think that they should be punished for their actions of trying to destroy anything that comes within, 4 inches of becoming even a competitor. And I think that there was someone that once told me, I said, hey, a few years ago when Twitter was in real trouble and going through lots of problems, shedding, executive staff, and it was actually, I think, 2 years ago. And I said, are you guys going to try to buy Twitter? And someone at Facebook said, why would we try to buy them? If we own them, we own pretty much every social platform except Snapchat, which we're going to destroy anyway. So then the regulators are going to come after us. And yet I feel like they've kind of let Twitter breathe on life support indefinitely, and yet they have tried to destroy all these other platforms, and I feel like it's coming to bite them in the ass, and I feel like it should. I feel like they shouldn't be able to just copy and try to destroy a competitor the way that they have with Snapchat, there needs to be something to stop this from happening in the future, because otherwise we're just stuck with the stale, boring platform that no one wants to use, and all they do is, check to see if they have any messages or go to events.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think that there is bipartisan support for, Facebook being regulated more heavily than it is now. You get that on the left with people with like the Elizabeth Warren types, and then you get it on the right with sort of the Bannonite crew. They are kind of anti big tech, and so who knows what can happen in the next 3 years, if anything.
Why do you think it is that Trump never took to Facebook?
I don't know. I mean, I think part of it is that he clearly has like a years-long history of loving tweeting out little 140-character missives. Maybe Facebook is like it offers too much for him. Like, it's too nuanced. Like, he has all the space he needs on Facebook, and I don't know if he's capable really of, frankly, writing like a 3,000-word missive that doesn't repeat himself 10 times and attach a photo or put in a link or something like that. He can barely handle, at replying people on Twitter. So I feel like that's Twitter's like the training wheels version of a social media platform for
Donald Trump. And last question about all this stuff, and we'll move on to some more Trump stuff real quick before we let you go is. One of the things that I have seen happening recently is people who used to use Facebook Messenger or even WhatsApp have now been switching to some of these more secure platforms like Signal and Telegram and things like that. So Facebook, there's been a lot of news lately about Facebook's privacy stuff, and this is something that the company has been guilty of since day one, and I've written about for over a decade now. But even some of this stuff has shocked me. There was a story, a lot of people have always questioned, how does Facebook know who your friends are? I've had instances where someone's been at my house, there was a guy who was helping us build some shelves, and next thing I know, I log on to Facebook a few days later, and he is a suggested friend, even though we have no friends in common. And I was like, holy shit, that was creepy. How the hell did Facebook know this person was at my house? Another instance I had was I was at a party once, and I about a month later ended up friending someone. And when we friended each other, it showed up in my newsfeed as Nick and this person became friends. They met at this party, which was in a party that I guess must have been on Facebook. But that was creepy too. How the fuck did they know that we met at this party? So there's been a lot of stories lately about how Facebook figures this stuff out. Can you tell us a little bit about some of these?
Yeah, there's one example that rings clear in my mind from a couple months ago. I think Splinter News might have reported it, but. Similarly, sex workers are being outed by the same thing where their clients will find them on Facebook later, despite the sex workers not giving them, you know, any sort of like personal information about themselves. They show up in the people you may know part of.
So people are sleeping with a prostitute and then they log onto Facebook a few days later and it suggests them as a friend?
Yes. Yeah, which is obviously a lot of sex workers don't use their real names or don't use their full names, and a lot of it is, like, privacy-related as part of the occupation. And
maybe this is why Trump doesn't use Facebook.
This is entirely possible, yes. But that's just one example.
Right,
there's a lot of those, yeah. Obviously, privacy is of utmost importance, I think, in this occupation in particular. And so for this to be happening really raises some questions about, you know, how, like you've said, like, how does Facebook know that you know these people? Why are they popping up in your feed like this? And this is a similar but slightly different topic. But something that finally made me delete Facebook from my phone was I would be talking about something with friends. Like, I think we were talking about Swell water bottles one time, the big metal water bottles. And I logged onto Facebook the next day, and it served me an ad immediately for the water bottles that we were talking about, which I thought was really creepy because it's not like we had, you know, typed it into Google or clicked on an article about it. Like, it was just a conversation we were having face-to-face while we were hanging out. And I think the privacy thing, that raises
questions. So wait, how do you think that they figured out that you were talking about these water bottles? Is it listening to your conversations?
We thought maybe it must have been like ambient listening, like picking up the app was on all of our phones. Maybe that's how it got picked up. It was very odd. And I talked to some people about this afterwards, and there's been a fair amount of kind of like speculative reporting about this phenomenon happening to many people. So it makes me wonder, you know, like what is Facebook listening to us? Like, is that what is happening, or is it just all a coincidence that's happened to dozens, if not hundreds, of people?
Well, there was a crazy story where I think it was just this last week, where it turns out that Facebook uses an algorithm to detect the dust particles on your phone with photos that you take, so on the camera, and it then will match those up to other photos of people and figure out that you know them based on the fact that these dust particles that our human eye can't see but an algorithm can are in the same photos, and then it suggests them as friends. I mean, this is some creepy shit. I mean, I just don't understand how we haven't stopped them from doing this stuff.
Yeah, me neither. I think the best advice is just, you know, use Facebook less and get it off your phone. I will never go back to having it on my phone, either Messenger or, you know, the normal Facebook app.
I feel like they're listening to this conversation right now. They're going to start suggesting water bottles to me next time I go on Facebook. All right, so just wrapping up here, we'll kind of wrap up with some Trump stuff. How do you think this all ends for Trump with the way he uses social media and so on? I mean, he's not going to be president forever. He, hopefully, unless this becomes a dictatorship. Eventually, Twitter and Trump are inexplicably tied together from now on. You know, if he does well, if there's drama around him, there's drama around them. And more people using it. Do you think that Trump eventually be kind of, you know, eventually he's not going to be the only thing we can talk about? And I'm glad we barely talked about him today. Eventually he's going to be kind of this thing on the side that you know, people are like, oh, remember that crazy guy? Providing we don't die in some sort of nuclear attack, of course. Is that the thing that, you know, does he eventually leave Twitter and go somewhere else? Does Twitter die as a result of Trump dying? How do you think this all kind of ends?
I think that maybe suggesting that I don't know if Twitter would die without Trump. I think that Twitter has been on life support for a long time, and it was on life support before Trump became a national phenomenon, and I think it'll still be on life support probably after he leaves office, assuming that we all make it through it and that he agrees to give up, you know, presidency at some point. But I do think that maybe he just kind of like folds into the ether at some point as like crazy old man yelling at cloud on Twitter. After his presidency, I hope anyway. I don't know. This is where I think the dummy Twitter account or Twitter app could really come in handy, where we just kind of like let him continue tweeting. And maybe this extends to building him like a fake Oval Office that he can go to every day and like tweet out of. I think you have to like construct a different reality for him so he'll finally get out of office.
Well, he does live in a different reality.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're gonna. So we should we start a cryptocurrency to fund this Trump coin?
I think it's time for Trump coin.
And then we can build this other reality, and he can pretend that he's president for the rest of his life. We'll have a fake Twitter account, even when Twitter is no longer here. All right, so last question, and then I'll let you get back to hating on social media. excuse me. How does this end for Twitter? We know how it ends for Trump, in complete oblivion, where someone else becomes president and saves the world from total annihilation and from the embarrassment that America has been through recently. but how does this end for Twitter? Is it 10 years from now or whatever? We don't have to say, put a date on it, but is it is it acquired by Verizon? Does it just kind of linger on life support forever? Does it grow its users? You know, what do you think based on your what you know from the people that use it and all the reporting you've done on it? How do you think this all ends?
I don't think it's unfathomable to think that a Verizon type company could buy Twitter in 5 or 10 years. I think that's entirely plausible. I also think that might become a more likely outcome the more people get sick of social media and kind of move away from it and move into more, you know, like closed off private groups, Facebook groups, Snapchat, things like that, maybe other new social networks that pop up down the line. But I do think that the more that people, you know, in their minds, they probably do tie it to Trump in some capacity. And the more that people kind of get sick of both Trump and Twitter and kind of move away from Twitter, the more Twitter will dwindle. And I think that maybe after Trump would be the right time for Jack Dorsey to finally just, you know, pack it in and sell it to Verizon for maybe a fraction of what they could have sold it for a couple years ago.
Well, we will see. We will come back on this podcast, providing people still listen to podcasts then and haven't deleted them from their phone, and we will check in. Maya, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today, and make sure you stay off social media.
Thanks, Nick.
Thanks to my guest this week, Maya Kosoff. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave the greatest, most glowing 12-star review that you possibly can. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. Thanks to my editors at Vanity Fair. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors, Goop and Freshly. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I will see you all next week.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.